Well, today I'm doing something different, actually quite different than I've ever done. But we are digressing from our study through the book of Matthew. And I've completed a book and I want to speak on that book. And I've never done that before with the other books I've written. They've been made available to you at a discount more than they are in other places, but I've never spoken to them. But it's because of the subject matter of this one, the importance of it. And I will continue this tonight, and if it takes another Sunday night. But when you write a book, you have to believe the book's important, or you won't survive the process. I mean, you'll get the introduction and a few things like that, but you won't make it to the end. And so I always believe they're important or you couldn't write them. But there's a difference in being important and urgent. And this one is urgent. There's a difference in being important and you know there's only certain people that are going to read it and may even need to read it. But this one is not of that kind. It is one that everyone needs to read, or a book like it. We have to understand what's going on as Christians to be aware and to counter the advancement of what is popularly known as social justice and critical race theory. The Apostle John said, "I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in truth." And I can tell you that has been my heart and is to this very hour. Shepherds have to do a lot of study of subversive ideas, corrosive ideas to the gospel and to truth, and then speak them to the flock, to warn the flock so that they're not deceptively led into these false truths, even when they sound great. Anti-racism. What Christian is not against racism? Well, there may be some, but they're not faithful to Scripture. What about social justice? Who's not for social justice? What about ideas like wanting everybody to have an equal opportunity? Who's not for that? Black Lives Matters. What Christian doesn't believe that? But as everything, you can't judge a book by its cover. You can't judge ideas by their titles either. I use critical theory. That's what I'm going to use mostly during the discussion. And this is not what I'm talking to you about is the subject matter of the book. But if you read the book and you heard this, this adds to it. It doesn't replace it. I'm not repeating what's in there. Because there's a lot on this issue. I use critical theory because it's critical theory from which all of these other things flow. So I use critical theory, cultural Marxism, social justice because it's popular. Cultural Marxism shows you the connection to Marxism, and critical theory is what Max Horkheimer developed out of the Frankfurt School in Germany, a neo-Marxist. But everything flows from critical theory, so I use that a lot in this talk, but any one of those I use is just an overarching. They're not synonymous, but they're interchangeable. But they include things like intersectionality, critical race theory, liberation theology, wokeness, and what are the other terms? You know, they're just tons of terms, so they're all included in that. The title of the book is called A Corruption of Consequence. And the corruption, particularly what I'm talking about, is the corrupting of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that is, there's a massive move to attach social justice to the gospel. Meaning when we speak the gospel, we share the gospel, we preach the gospel, you believe the gospel, this social justice has to be included in it, rather than being a result from it. In other words, biblically, you hear the gospel, it changes you, and now you view all people created in the image of God and so forth and so on, but they're making it a part of the gospel, a requirement. That's the corruption which the book was premised upon, but the corruption extends further. Yes, it undermines the entire redemptive plan of God, but it extends to every facet of our life, period. The nature of the book, it's written so that everyone can understand it. So I worked very hard, you'll have to determine yourself, but I always had everyone in mind when I was writing it, and so I tried to keep things out that I thought were too weedy and deep, and I've actually thought about writing an intermediate book between this up here that's very difficult and this one that I think is for everybody, and write another one. And I tried to keep thinking that so I wouldn't keep interjecting that. So this is supposed to be for everyone to read and to become conversant so that you don't just understand it, but you can talk to somebody, whether it's your children or neighbor or whoever it is. It's made for people who have a background in it and don't have a background in it. So that was always being considered. Because all of us need to know this. We must understand that social justice is Marxian social justice. Or you could call it socialistic justice. But it is not God's impartial justice drawn and relayed in the scripture. We become conversant when we can say things that make the other side realize that not every disparity and every difference in outcome proves oppression, racism, as I'll demonstrate today. It's a biblical worldview versus a social justice or a socialistic or a Marxist worldview. It's the shortest book I've ever written. So that was my attempt to make it accessible. So the last one was 300 pages. This is, I'm not going to tell you, but it's not near that long. It's short. I want you to understand what's behind the curtain. And I will say, if you do not understand it, you will be drawn into it. And you will become complicit. And your children and your grandchildren. It is seductive and alluring. The urgency of the book, unlike my others, again, important versus urgency. We've been engulfed by a philosophical tsunami. All of us are in it. It doesn't affect one area of society. Social justice, properly understood, is an attempted Marxian socialistic coup d'etat. It is an advancing, pervasive and sophisticated attempt to overthrow America. It is in every area and strata of society, whether that's the federal and state government, primary and secondary education, academia, politics, religion, Christianity, conservative evangelicalism, the SBC, or even our seminaries. Whether it will fail or not, I do not know. I don't make those kind of predictions. Whether it will continue as it is with full steam, or it will ebb and flow, I do not know. I do know it is dangerously and deadly serious, and it is a reality. It is not coming. It is here. It will destroy everything good that we know, every civil blessing from God that we know in America and America itself. That is what it's about. It is being used to usher in a Marxist overthrow of Christianity, America, free speech, private property, capitalism, religious and civil freedom. If successful, all will be lost. People say, well, that can't happen in America. That's what they say in every country until it happens. Presently, the critical theorists have the cultural power, and since the election, they have the political power. They're dominating culture. Don't think in terms of Republican versus Democrat or conservative versus liberal. Those are not the categories to help you navigate this. We cannot ignore it because we cannot escape its presence or its ruinous goals if it succeeds. It will affect every one of us in a devastating way. Without God's mighty work and His people, along with other freedom-loving people in America, I see no human way to stop it. Though I could be wrong, and I hope I am, but I don't think I am. It will divide America until America ceases to exist. That's the stated goal of critical theory. These theorists hate America. I never used the words that politicians or Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservatives, I never used the word in all of my preaching that one side or the other hated America. They loved America. It's what's called classic liberalism. They just had a different view than, say, me as a conservative, but we all loved America. That's not true of this group. They hate America. They want to destroy it in every way. These theorists hate America, the Constitution, free speech, capitalism, private property, Christianity, the nuclear family, law and order, patriotism, and a democratic or republican form of government, or a mixture of both. Antonio Gramsci is one of the two most prominent neo-Marxists. So you had classical Marxism, Karl Marx, and that was the proletariat against the bourgeoisie, and it failed. And then you had the Frankfurt School, and the neo-Marxists were trying to figure out what went wrong, what happened. And one of the primary ones, Max Horkheimer is one of them, but one of the two primary ones in developing what's called neo-Marxism or cultural Marxism is Herbert Marcuse and Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was a part of the Frankfurt School. He's an Italian, and he was imprisoned under Mussolini, the fascist. And that was to stop him from speaking. But he was a prolific writer, and so he wrote the whole time he was in prison. And once he was released and ultimately died, his papers were all written in Italian, and then they were translated into English in the 70s, so now we have access to them. And remember, he's one of the two. Some say he is the father of cultural Marxism, which I refer to. But if he's not the father, he's a co-founder. And he said this, quote, "Socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity. In the new order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society," end quote. I preached a series in March 2020, which is 1 year ago, and I spoke on cultural Marxism, and I understood at the time and that many didn't know why I was speaking on it, and surely why I would have four messages on it, because most people have never heard of cultural Marxism or critical race theory or intersectionality or any of these things, and I understood that. But no sooner than we finished that brief introduction into this, critical theory dropped out of academia onto Main Street and every street USA, and it did so with a vengeance. And it is unabated. It is stronger today. It has infiltrated more. It is more exposing its true beliefs, becoming more bold. Whoever or whichever church does not become informed in this will be drawn in it. I'm not slighting people or churches. I'm saying that's how seductive it is. Even if you never hear the words critical race theory or intersectionality. And I find this all the time. People are saying the very things that come from critical theory, not the Bible. And they never heard of critical theory or critical race theory or intersectionality. You will, your children, your grandchildren will be drawn in and become complicitous. It is seductively deceptive. In America, I've mentioned there are two civil things that we have in society that come about by constitution, voting, but the political process. One of them is we have freedom. These are how we have global missions, and we have evangelism on the scale that we have it and have had it. And that is, you have religious freedom, the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, all these things. You have freedom. If you don't have that, you can't. You can do evangelism. Maybe you can do international missions. Probably not. But you can do something, but not on the scale that we do it. And you have to have economic wealth, meaning that individuals have to have discretionary income that they can choose to put it over here, or they can put it in mission, they can do anything they want with it. That comes from capitalism. You don't have discretionary wealth in communism and socialism. So those two things alone are why we can do evangelism and missions worldwide to the scale that we do it. If you lose those two things, you kill it. And both of those things are hated by critical theorists, and they seek to destroy them, period. I want to speak about white group racism. Now, this is normally goes under the terms of structural racism, systemic racism, white privilege, things like that. But what the reason I want to call it white group racism, as you'll see some distinctions between Martin Luther King and what's going on now, but it's the Bible as well. In this critical theory, this group is racist. Because why? They're white. Has nothing to do with you personally, nothing to do with your life, what you believe, nothing. You're in the group. This group is not racist. Doesn't matter if they hate everybody else on the planet that's a different race than them. We use ethnicity. There's really one race created in the image of God, but this is the way the terms are used. They could hate everybody, but they're still not racist because they belong to this group. So it's group identity. And this is what Marxism does. It always puts you in a group, and personal responsibility and belief becomes basically dismissed. When they use terms like white and black, it means more than the color of your skin. Though it does mean that, but it's more than that. It means a mindset. So if a black person's truly black, they would say, he will have a certain mindset. And a white person will have a certain mindset. They're racist. So let me give you an example. If a person who is black skinned, loves America, wants to participate in the country and the blessings of it, as Martin Luther King avowed himself, he did. That's all he wanted, was to participate. If they want to, and they work hard, and they become successful, they will be labeled by critical theorist blacks as white supremacists. If you think that's an overstatement, ask Candace Owens, Clarence Thomas, Condoleezza Rice, Thomas Sowell, and millions of other blacks who have succeeded and do well. Why are they called white supremacists? Because they're said to have adopted white values, not human values, but white values. And therefore, they're acting white. That's what they do. They emphasize black values and white values. As Christians, we emphasize Christian values, American values, and human values. Robin DiAngelo, in her book, White Fragility, which is the number one bestseller, most read book on this subject in America. It's the book that kind of provides the basis for all of the sensitivity trainings that go on in the corporate world and government, state and federal, and in education. So it's the book. Bestseller, number one bestseller. And so D'Angelo says in that book, and I quote, "A positive white identity is an impossible goal. White identity is inherently racist." The word inherent means that you cannot get it out of it. Although God made people as they are in these unchangeable and attributes we have. She argues that white people don't need to be denying that they're racist. I mean, they are. We all know it. Why? Because they're white. But what they need to be saying is this, quote, "I strive to be less white. To be less white is to be less racially oppressive," end quote. So if you're a white person, according to critical theory, you are supposed to spend the rest of your life, because you never get straight. You will never get over being a racist. They don't offer an end. But you're to focus the rest of your life and your children's lives on becoming less white so you'll be less oppressive. I give arguments in the book against this. This is racism. Does anybody see it? I can tell what you believe and who you are by the color of your skin. That's racism. Pure and simple. The truth of the matter is, anyone from any country, be they Nigerian, Irish, Jew, Chinese, Japanese, Indian, Arabian, add to the list, when they come to America, they immigrate to America, they come in as a minority. And as a minority going into any group where there's a majority, you are always have some discrimination. And they usually come in absolutely impoverished. And when you read their stories, some of the squalor that they lived in and how they lived, because they had nothing. They left and lost everything, but they wanted to get to America. They are considered by critical theory, critical race theory, as oppressed. But what happens with these immigrants, in two or three generations, they become successful. So the first generation, maybe the parent works as the lowest thing you can think of, barely making enough, maybe working 80 hours a week so their kids can go to school. And then those kids send their kids to school. Two or three generations, they're successful. Many times passing the majority of peers. So when they came, they were considered oppressed by critical theory. But once they become successful, they're called white racist. She says, don't go back to your Irish origins or anything like that. Because they're white racists too, once they become successful, see. The same is true of people who are black in America, or they're black from anywhere else in the world. If they break out and they do the work, which many of them do, millions of them do, they surpass their white peers, then they are cast out by the critical theorist. And they're a white supremacist. Why? Because they're acting white. That's Marxism. That is not a continuation of civil rights leaders who loved America, loved the Constitution, loved the Bill of Rights, like Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, and Martin Luther King. Kimberly Crenshaw, a law professor, and a lot of this started in legal theory, and she and Derrick Bell are usually attributed or given the credit of being the founders of critical race theory. and started back in the 70s and again out of legal theory and so forth. She's also the one who coined the term intersectionality. And in her scholarly paper called Mapping the Margins, and you can read this, I'm paraphrasing, but she talks about black people should not say, and here's the phrase, "I am a person who happens to be black." The reason is because that's a tie to our common humanity. In other words, when you say, if you can say, "He's a person who happens to be black," you're tying us together as all people, see, humans. Just some are black, some are brown, some are white, some are whatever. And she says, we're not to do that. But to say, "I am black," quote, as a resistance statement. Because the other is focusing on our common humanity and draws us together. And "I am black" is a powerful statement. It's identity politics is what it is that only divides. Now I want you to think for a moment what I just said. Don't say, "I am a person who happens to be black." Don't focus on your humanity, our common humanity, but black identity. And you're this identity, this identity, this identity. Go back to the civil rights movement of the 60s. You can go on the internet. You can actually watch these, the marches and stuff. And you'll see black men carrying signs. "I am a man." That's all it says. "I am a man. I'm a man with black skin. You're a man with white skin." You see? It was all about our common humanity. Martin Luther King, well, you well know, in his famous "I Have a Dream" speech, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." That is called colored blindness, meaning that color is way back here, character is way out here. Color blindness is personal, if you'll notice. We can't say this group is racist or this group's not racist. It matters about you. It's personal responsibility. Remember, Martin Luther King, unlike critical theorists who are coming from a Marxian base, an atheistic base, he was coming from a Christian base, a biblical base. In critical race theory, it's group classification, and there's utter dismissal of personal belief or character. And therefore, it is Marxian. Black Lives Matter, critical theorists, critical race theorists like Crenshaw, D'Angelo, Bell, and all the others, they reject the concept of color blindness. They reject it. Now you have to understand, in elite circles, it is rejected. And by the way, I'm just going to tell you, if you say it, and it is a biblical position, if you say it, though, with one of them, you will be attacked viciously. You have to understand that. That's why politicians don't use it. Because from the elite guardians, they will be attacked. But when they do studies of the average person and they say, when they just do the population in America, do you think this person, when they go to hire out for this job, if they're black or white, do you think that should matter? They say, no. They're colorblind, see? Did you know that they've done things with orchestras? So they're trying to get people in the orchestra. And they developed something a number of decades ago where it would be a blind audition. So all you would hear is the instrument. You wouldn't see the people because everybody has biases. So some of them, they might see, it doesn't just race, but it's like you might see a little bitty person playing a tuba and that didn't look right to you, see? Or a great big person with a violin and you didn't. So they made it where they couldn't see them. And if you got accepted, all they heard was your music. That's called colorblindness. They didn't see anything except your music. Critical theorists have fought against that because they want the same number there, see? To put it more bluntly, D'Angelo, in her book, White Fragility, when she speaks of color blindness, she says, quote, color blind racism, end quote. That's what she calls it. Color blind, that's what Martin Luther King and the civil rights leaders of the 60s fought for. Now they're fighting for what's called race consciousness. And the colored blind principle, it really doesn't have anything to do with how much racism it is. It's about changing people's hearts. But the colorblind principle is that it shouldn't matter, and that's the goal. That's the aspiration. And race consciousness, and they are not compatible. It is colorblind principle puts race back here and character out there. Race consciousness puts race out here. And that's all that matters. King's goal and critical race theory's goal are not the same. King's goal is not cherished like you would think it would be. King's goal is sometimes degraded, like I just quoted from the most popular book. But if it's not degraded, or if it's not something said about it in a passing way, it's just ignored. I mean, you can just read their literature. It's just ignored. It's like it doesn't exist. But they can't criticize Martin Luther King because you would lose too many supporters. So he's in many ways ignored or given a pat, or that was back then, or that's passé, just a lot of different ways that they handle it. Color blindness means that anyone can be a racist, doesn't matter what group you're in. It's an aspiration that shows no racism towards anyone, regardless if they're in power or not in power. Critical race theory defines racism as only those in power can be racist. That's how that works. So the colorblind principle, which is biblical, Martin Luther King and others, because it was Christian-based, by the way, that's what they were doing. It doesn't say we don't see color. It doesn't say that. Now, I understand people, they're trying to help, and they say, well, I don't see color. Well, I don't think that's true, but that's not what colorblind means. Colorblind means, so in this church, we have 10-plus ethnicities. We've had all kinds through the years. So when I walk down the hall, I see a white person, I see a black person, I see a Korean person, I see a Vietnamese person, I see a Taiwanese person, I see a Chinese person, I see them. It's not what it means. It means I see them, and it doesn't make any difference. That's what the colorblind principle is. I see it. It doesn't make any difference. It's to be that way before the law and before opportunity and all of these things. D'Angelo, and critical theorist, if you provide evidence that you are not a racist and you're white, like a biracial marriage or a family dynamic, or your testimony, things that you can share. That doesn't demonstrate to a critical theorist you're not a racist. That demonstrates you are a racist when you give evidence that you're not. It proves you are. It's your white fragility. If you push back, if you get upset being called a racist, that proves you're a racist. If you don't get upset and say, I'm a racist, then you're a racist. There's no way out. If you follow their line, that's your white fragility. If you believe in science, if you believe in hard work, which is the Puritan work ethic, by the way, in America, if you believe in punctuality, if you believe in doing things like homework, that's all racist. That's all out of white supremacy. We have studies of how much homework different groups of children do, how much time they spend in that each night. Martin Luther King said this, the worth of an individual does not lie in the measure of his intellect, his racial origin, or his social position. Human worth lies in relatedness to God An individual has value because he has value to God. Whenever this is recognized, whiteness and blackness pass away as determinants in a relationship, and son and brother are substituted, end quote. That's the case that I make in the book. We must not give in to atheistic, materialistic, socialistic, Marxian definitions of human beings and racism. We must not. We must counter it with the truth of the Word of God. For critical theorists, the question is not, did racism take place? It is, how did it manifest itself? Because according to critical theory, it's always present, always, in every space, all the time, period. It's the ordinary, and every denial that it's not there proves it is there, and every recognition that it's there proves it's there. If you do something, if you try to say that you love blacks or Chinese or whoever it is, if you try to do that, that's called interest convergence, meaning the only reason you did it was not because you really mean it, but it benefited you. What a condescending, worse, cynical view of other groups could one have? It may be true of some, but to say it's true of a group because of the color of their skin, that has no biblical foundation. In D'Angelo's book, White Fragility, remember the number one book used. It's the basis of most of the sensitivity training and government education, corporate sensitivity training, and so forth. She never mentions in that book, you can read it from cover to cover, critical theory. She never mentions Max Horkheimer, who developed critical theory, out of the Frankfurt School. She never mentions the Frankfurt School. She never mentions that it comes from neo-Marxism, including Horkheimer. She never mentions Marcuse or Gramsci, two most famous neo-Marxists. Max Weber never mentions them. But when you read her scholarly works that are intended to train scholars and some educators, for example, the book in the Multicultural Education Series for Training Teachers and Scholars, and the title of it is Everyone Really Equal? She does mention it. Not only mention it, she explicitly attributes what they're saying in the book about critical social justice to Max Horkheimer, critical theory, the Frankfurt School. She mentions explicitly on the foundation of critical theory of Herbert Marcuse. The Frankfurt School, it was neo-Marxists trying to figure out what was wrong with Marxism so we can fix it and we can use it again. She actually explicitly mentions Karl Marx by name. And she's saying this about him as being foundational. Quote, Karl Marx's analysis of capitalism and social stratification, end quote. Let me give you his analysis, and anybody that looks at Marxism will know this. This is one of the first things you learn about Marxism. It is that capitalism is the great evil from which all other evils come. Private property, evil. So we know what he believes about that. There is no doubt. Neo-Marxists the same. And the social stratification. What does Marxism say? We're supposed to try to make everybody have the same outcome. We already know. She says that's the foundation. So when I bring up and I say cultural Marxism, you shouldn't say that. You know, you're just trying to upset me. It really doesn't have anything to do with that. Oh, really? It seems like if they say it, I ought to be able to say it. Though they are guarded in what forums they say it. Your children will never hear them use those words. So you can rest easy about that. People say it's wrong to mention, so I wrote a document. I hadn't had time to put it out yet, but it has 30 reasons why not only can we use cultural Marxism in this, but we should use it. So the sensitivity training at work that you may have to go to, or at school, or your preschoolers, or your kindergarten children, or your first grade, secondary, third grade, all the way through, they'll be being taught this, but they'll never hear those words, critical theory, Horkheimer, Frankfurt School, Karl Marx. They'll never hear it. But that's what they're being taught. Make no mistake about it. That's what they're being taught. They call for critical education, and I can't say this doggedly, but I can tell you it. I can say this. I can't say everything with critical in front of it has to do with critical theory, but I can say this. If when you see the word critical, critical legal theory, critical social theory, critical this, this, and this, it is going back to critical theory. You'll be right more times, you'll be wrong, and you may never be wrong. I just haven't looked at every piece of information. So let me talk about the myth of equal outcomes. So there's a view, and this is what critical theory is all about. This is what Marxism, socialism is all about. We see outcomes that are different. Therefore, there must be oppression. There must be some people oppressing and some people oppressed because there are unequal outcomes, you see? So what the fallacy in the myth is that if everything was right, if there was no racism, no oppression, everybody would, there would be equal outcomes. We'd all be the same. We wouldn't have all of these disparities. So the fundamental thing is that all disparities are due to racism and oppression. That's the only answer given. So I showed you last week, I mentioned just one thing, just one. Children growing up in the same home do not have the same outcome in education, economically, and other life areas. They just don't. Same home, same race, same parents, same economics. Everything's the same. Did you know the same is true with twins? Did you know the same thing is true with identical twins? That you can have identical twins and you can study them and follow them, and they don't have the same outcomes in education, in economics, and their life. They don't even have the same interest many times. One goes one way and one goes the other. And thus the outcomes are different. If children out of the same home or twins do not achieve the same levels or experience the same outcomes, we can say such disparities are not due to racism or oppression. And thus, we should not accept that all disparities are because of racism and oppression. Some may be. That's one of the things on the table. Is this because of racism or oppression? Maybe. There are bigots and idiots everywhere. But they make it the only one. And by that I mean the normality of unequal outcomes does not mean racism doesn't exist. Just because it's normal for there to be different outcomes doesn't mean that some of them aren't due to racism or oppression, or that racism doesn't exist. It doesn't mean that. But it does undermine the claim that all disparities are because of racism or oppression. It undermines the claim of systemic racism and oppression exist because there are unequal outcomes. So this is where they begin. Unequal outcome, oppression. That's the answer for everything. Did you know that Asians do better on average than white people? Did you know that? And black people, by the way. They do that in education in America. But did you know that's true of the Western Hemisphere? Did you know that? In the Western world, Asians do better than whites or blacks. Did you know Harvard discriminated against Asians? Too many of them getting in. I mean, it was making their, chart look bad. So they started discriminating. Didn't matter how good their scores were, they just wouldn't take them. And they filed suit. I don't know how it ended. Did you know that Asians get home loans at a higher rate than whites and blacks? That's right. Some of the examples that they used, and I think there was redlining and all these things. I think many times there was discrimination. So we're not denying that. We're trying to say that it's Marxian to say everything's from that. So we now know that some of the studies they used to prove that whites got more home loans than blacks, they didn't tell you the whole thing. When you actually looked at the documents, Asians got more than either one of those groups. Then they found out, bad mistake, that sometimes the bank that was giving higher percentage of loans to Asians and whites and blacks was owned by blacks. How's that discrimination? Maybe there are other factors that need to be considered. It's true that generally Asian cultures value this. They value education. They value frugality. And they value hard work. Does anybody wonder why they succeed in America? Does anybody have a... That's it. You know what many white Americans are missing? Sometimes all three. That's why they succeed. It's not magic. Nigerians, I'm not trying to be condescending. I just want you thinking about what I'm saying rather than to figure out where everybody's from. So, Nigerians are black and they're from Africa. But did you know they're some of the top in education in our country? U.S. Census Bureau, 61.4% of Nigerian Americans age 25 years or older hold a bachelor's degree or higher. That's compared with 28.5% of the total U.S. population. So the black Nigerians from Africa have twice as many of them, percentage-wise, that hold bachelor degrees than Americans, people born here. The Migration Policy Institute reports that 29% of Nigerian Americans have master's degrees, PhD, or an advanced professional degree. Compare that with 11% of the U.S. population. Three times. Three times more Nigerians have these graduate degrees and doctoral degrees than Americans born here. I don't know how you get racism out of that. You say, why aren't I hearing these things? Because they don't fit what a Marxist socialist goal is. Nigerians do better than Somalian immigrants. So Somalians are black and they're from Africa. So Nigerians and Somalians are all from Africa. Did you know that the Nigerians do better educationally and monetarily than Somalians? Did you know that? They're all black and they're all from Africa. You know what the difference is? There may be others, but there's a couple of differences that we know for a fact. One is that Nigeria was colonized by the Brits. As bad as that is, they learned English. So when they come to America and the Somalians come into America, the Nigerians way ahead of them because they can speak English. A second thing, when they look at their subcultures, they find the Somalians don't value education, but the Nigerians value it. Thomas Sowell, in his book, Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, Nigerians, for example, have been greatly overrepresented among black students and a number of elite educational institutions in America as they outperform native-born white students in British schools, meaning that the Nigerians come here and they surpass the native-born blacks here, and then you can just take it to other countries. They do better than Brits that were born in Britain. What about economics? The University of Kansas. Nigerian immigrants, because of education, have high percentage of managerial jobs. That's a quote. So Nigerians as black people who came from Africa are in a lot of management positions. Does anybody know why? Because they value education. That's why. And so they're hired. They adopted American values, human values, whatever you want to call them. Another part of that study in University of Kansas, the labor force participation rates of African-born immigrants are higher than that of foreign-born population and the general U.S. population. What that means is immigrants coming from Africa, now we've just spanned out to Africa, they come here and in a very short time, it's about a six-month window, they're self-sufficient. They don't get on welfare. They aren't a drain. They excel. Thomas Sowell again in The Wealth, Poverty, and Politics. Economically, nearly one-fourth of Nigerian households in the United States have annual incomes of $100,000 compared to 10.6% of black American households that are born here. So the Nigerian blacks have 2.5 times more households that have $100,000 income than native-born black Americans. So the question is, if structural systematic racism exists and all disparities are due to racism, then why do Nigerians do better than Somalians? And Nigerians do better than black Americans and white Americans? And why do Asians do better than everybody else? If we have systemic and structural racism, it's not a denial of racism. It is a denial of structural and systemic that you can't become somebody because of it. And by the way, and I have talked to, and I don't remember if they were giving me this because they know I'm sports dumb or what, but they said it, so I'm quoting them, these sports sophisticates sitting over here. So I'm talking to them about, have you ever noticed how many whites are in the NFL? How many white people? You ever notice that? Or in the NBA? Ever notice the ratio with blacks? You know why? Because sports is a pure meritocracy. And blacks value it, whites value it, but you know what? You can come up with all the reasons, but just blacks do better. That's right. I understand about 70% are black. Do you think we should have affirmative action there? Have you ever noticed? Just think about it. How many Jews do you see in the NBA? How many Asians in the NBA and the NFL? Should we equal this thing out? Should we do that? You know what it would do? Destroy sports. It would destroy it. You never hear about that being criticized. America has racism, but it is not systemically racist. But that's what they must prove in order to justify dismantling our history, everything about us, not focusing on any of the good, and there are many problems, and we stand against those today. Abortion would be the biggest there is. But it doesn't mean there's not good. And it doesn't mean the whole system needs to be destroyed. It needs to be purified. So America has racism, but it's not systemically racist. But that is what must be proven. And when you see racism or oppression as the cause of all disparities and unequal outcomes, that is Marxism. And you can go to any country in the world, and you can go to any century in the world, and you can go to any group of people in the world. It doesn't make any difference. There's always disparities, and there are many reasons for this that are not bad. They want to replace America with socialism and communism. And the way that Marx set it up in the beginning in classical and now in cultural Marxism and neo-Marxism is that it's always an oppressor and oppressed dynamic, which will rip you apart. They said every disparity is racism or oppression, and that is not true. it is objectively not true. And by the way, if you try to bring objective evidence, a critical theorist will say that's white supremacy. I know you think some of this, he's overstating it. No, I'm not. No, I'm quoting them. I'm quoting them. If you bring facts, that's white supremacy. And it's utterly dismissed. God needs to give us truth. We need to understand the hour in which we live for the sake of the gospel. We need to speak that truth. And it's going to take courage. Because you have to understand there's no disagreement with critical race theory. You either agree or we'll destroy you. That's what you see going on in culture. They talk about destroying this or quietening this. It's all about destruction. I've seen it on a personal level. You can see it on a societal level, a city level. Businesses give into this, and they don't understand. They get a few people that are doing this, and they give in, and they're never satisfied. There is no end. You need to understand that. You can't do enough. And whatever you do that looks good, it's because you did it for yourself. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that we would be people that speak the truth in love, and that we would confess any sense of valuing one race or ethnicity over another, because truly there is only one race created by you in your image. And through time and migrating from Genesis 11 to different areas of the globe and developing different cultures and different gene pools that become dominant and features, but they're all superficial. And Lord, may we be the ones that are the most clear about this. And if we have any sense of that in us, making one ethnicity or race that is inherently inferior than another, God, may we confess it and repent and run from it. For it disparages them who are created in your image, us as your voice piece, and you who created all of us. And we do focus on the humanity. And we do see colors. And we see features. And we hear talk. And we see customs. And we see all this stuff. But we say it doesn't matter. These are people with different customs and color of skin and features. And so, Lord, I pray in our own heart we would make sure we're right with you on this. And then we would speak it, and there will be fallout. Lost friendships, family members, called every name in the book. But we need to be strong for the truth and for the gospel. We love you, and we ask it in Christ's worthy name. Amen.